So let's chant the refuge and bodhicitta on page 8. In Buddha, Dharma, and Supreme Spiritual Community, we go for refuge until fully enlightened by the power of all six perfections, from generosity to non-dual wisdom. For the sake of all beings, may we realize Buddhahood. So we've been doing a variety of wisdom meditation practices, and over the last couple of days, we've been introduced to some of the equanimity practices, and I'd like to complement that tonight by doing a guided loving-kindness meditation. So, make yourselves comfortable, because the cultivation of the positive emotions, love, joy, compassion, equanimity, are fostered by comfort in the body. So make yourselves comfortable. Take a few deep breaths. By all means, move the body to release and relax any tension. And now, think of someone you love. Either think of them or hold an image of them. See them. And notice any feeling of love that arises, or any positive feeling, or any other feelings that arise. If other feelings arise, just let them be there. And you might have a sense of yourself, if you wish. You might see yourself or feel yourself as though you're breathing through the center of your chest, and that there's a sense of warmth as you breathe in and out through the center of your chest. And this merges with, melts with, enhances the sense of love you feel for this person. And allow yourself to enjoy this feeling. And allow any other feelings to be there. And now extend this sense of love and this intention for well-being to the person, the people on either side of you. So you're wishing well for the people on either side of you. And if you wish, you may want to repeat a phrase. A phrase that is conducive to the feeling of love and of kindness and of goodwill. You might, for example, repeat quietly to yourself as you think of the person on either side of you, may you be happy joyful, loving, peaceful. May you be happy, joyous, loving, peaceful. And now extend that intention of well-being also to the person behind and in front of you. So now you're wishing well to the person on beside you and in front and behind. May you be happy, joyful, loving, peaceful. And now extend the circle of your care to everyone in the room. May you be happy, joyful, loving, at peace. So now you're wishing well, giving love to everyone in the room. And now, as you repeat whatever phrase works for you, be sure to include yourself. So you're including everyone in this room without exception or reservation. May you be happy, joyful, loving, peaceful. And now extend your good wishes further out to everyone in the Mental Physics Institute, all the staff and residents here, the people who look after us and look after this place and make our retreat possible, as well as everyone in the room. May you be happy, joyful, loving, peaceful. And now extend further to include everyone in this town. Embrace everyone in this environment with your good wishes. May you all be happy, joyful, loving, at peace. And now embrace everyone in neighboring towns and cities extending out across the desert. May you be happy, joyful, loving, peaceful. And now think of everyone in the state of California, all these people, and include them all in your loving embrace. May you all be happy, joyful, loving, peaceful. Just as I want to be happy and loving, so too may you, all of you, be happy and loving. And now let your awareness and loving embrace extend further to embrace everyone in this country. May all people in this country be happy, joyful, loving, and at peace. And just repeat that, or whatever phrase works for you. Allowing whatever reactions arise, whatever emotions arise, to simply to be there. No need to do anything with them. Just notice them and continue your loving intent. And now extend further to embrace everyone on this continent. May all these people be happy, joyful, loving, and peaceful. And now let your awareness expand and your circle of care expand to include this entire planet and all the people on it. May all people be happy, joyful, loving, peaceful. May all people be happy, joyful, loving, peaceful. And now include all conscious creatures so that your good wishes, your love, embraces all conscious creatures and people on this planet. May all beings be happy, joyful, loving, peaceful. So desiring happiness and joy and love and peace for all beings on this planet without exception or reservation. With each repetition of the phrase, again, cultivating that desire, that intention, and allowing whatever emotions or reactions occur simply to be there. And now extend your awareness beyond this planet to the farthest reaches of space and time, to encompass every conceivable conscious being in all directions, across all space and time. May all beings be happy, joyous, loving, peaceful. May all beings everywhere be happy, joyful, loving, peaceful. And now bring your awareness back to this room and to the people in it. And once again, with this open heart and mind, which has been open to all beings, now just focus on the people in this room. And as fully and deeply as you can, raise the desire, the aspiration, may you be happy, joyful, loving, and at peace. May everyone in this room be happy, joyful, loving, and at peace. And now open yourself to the fact that every single person in this room is wishing you as fully as they can that you be happy, joyful, loving, and at peace. Let in the fact that every single person here is wishing you well. You are the focus and center of all these good wishes, all this love. Let it in. And what does it feel like to recognize that every single person around you is wishing you well? What is it like to recognize that every single person here is cultivating and feeling love for you, just as you are? And if it feels right, acknowledge to yourself that yes, right now, exactly as you are utterly lovable. And when you're ready, open your eyes and look around at these people who are wishing you love and happiness and joy and peace. That was fun. So there are many ways to look at the fruits of the practices we're doing, but one of them is to recognize that we are cultivating our hearts and minds in ways which allow us to be more loving and to be more able to accept love. And the practices we're doing, which are multiple, interdependent and mutually supportive. And one of the most foundational practices, in fact, in many traditions, it's regarded as the foundation of spiritual life, is ethicality. And ethical living is absolutely crucial to the capacity to be able to give and receive love. And so I want to focus on that this evening, looking at the way our ethical choices mold our lives. Now, it's interesting that every single one of the authentic religious and spiritual traditions emphasizes the importance of ethics. In some traditions, it's known as the Golden Rule: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Or in some traditions, it's known as the silver rule: don't do to others what you don't want them to do to you. But the general message is the same. Now, the key factor in ethics and ethical living is the intention with which the intentions or motivations driving behavior. And this is widely recognized. There's a beautiful line from Muhammad: all actions are judged by the motives prompting them. And for the purposes of our discussion here, I want to suggest that given how crucial intention is, in fact, it's said that our lives rest on the pinpoint of our intentions, that we can describe or define an intention as ethical to the extent to which it aims to enhance the well-being of everyone, including ourselves. Okay, so an intention is ethical to the extent it aims, or we aim, to enhance the welfare of everyone, including ourselves. Now, the including ourselves is crucial, because that's what shifts the intention from sacrifice to enlightened self-interest. Okay? When we get if it's acting out of sacrifice, watch out. Now, just to throw in another very useful concept here, in Buddhist psychology, there's also spoken of a concept of that's used of skillfulness. And an act is said to be skillful to the extent it benefits everyone, including oneself. Now, the distinction between ethical intentions and skillful behavior is a crucial one, because one of the existential challenges of being a human being is that we never know how things are going to turn out. So we can act with great ethics and great ethical, wonderful ethical intentions, and still we don't have control over how things turn out. And we don't know for sure. That's just part of our existential dilemma as human beings. Limits of our knowledge. All we can do is do our practice, bring as much sensitivity and clarity to each situation as we can, look within, feel for what the appropriate action is in the moment, as Lama Surya was talking about this morning, and then do it, and then acknowledge that that's the key. We can't necessarily control the outcome. Now, in talking about ethics, it's really crucial to recognize that there are different levels at which this is understood. Okay? Just like the reading of texts or listening to Dharma occurs at multiple levels, so too ethics is understood at multiple levels. And one of the things that happens as we practice is that the depth of our understanding of all these virtues grows or deepens as we practice. Now, to keep things simple, I just want to draw a distinction between what we could call conventional and contemplative ethics. Conventional ethics is basically set around a set of rules, and they're often fear-based. You know, do this or God will get you. Or do this or the police will get you. God's representative, I guess. That works to civilize people, some people anyway, and it's probably essential at a certain conventional stage. But it's a tragedy when that understanding is the deepest understanding that we or a culture holds. And there are higher levels or deeper levels, whichever metaphor you want to use, of ethics. And those are the contemplative understandings. But they're less commonly known. Confucius described it beautifully, saying, Confucius sighed, "Rare are those who understand virtue." And Confucius himself gave one of the most exquisite descriptions of the maturation of ethics through a lifetime. And he said, and I just love this quote, he said, "At 15, I set my heart upon learning. At 30, my feet were planted firm upon the way. At 40, I no longer suffered from perplexities. At 50, I could hear the biddings of heaven. At 60, I could hear them with a docile ear. And at 70, I could follow the desires of my heart, for what I desired no longer overstepped the boundaries of what is right." That's a beautiful account of a lifetime's maturation of ethics, from beginning at 15, at 30, having some stability, at 40, no longer suffering from perplexities, no longer being riddled with conflict about, what to do or whether I'm really going to follow through with it. At 50, I knew what were the biddings of heaven. That is an internal sense. And one of the beauties of spiritual practice is that as we become more sensitive, we learn that we have this internal guidance system. We have an intuitive sensitivity and capacity which we can feel into and have a sense of what's appropriate in each moment. It's like a homing, guidance system. It literally is calling us home. At 60, I heard them with a docile ear. Again, no conflict, just being able to follow these deeper ethical promptings. And at 70, I could follow the dictates of my own heart, for what I desired no longer overstepped the boundaries of what is right. So why are we unethical? Well, basically, at times we're overwhelmed by painful, destructive emotions and motives like greed and fear and anger and jealousy and rage, etc. And because we are ignorant or unconscious of the causes and costs of unethical action. In short, we're unethical because we're blinded and driven by the three poisons, greed, hatred, and delusion. Or if you wish to expand them into the five poisons, greed, hatred, delusion, pride, and jealousy. Familiar friends, all of them. And one of the main reasons that we're not ethical or as ethical as we might be is because we don't really see and understand the full implications and the consequences. So we don't really understand until we refine, work on this and explore ethics. We don't really understand the costs, the full costs, both the immediate costs and the longer term ones. The immediate costs are basically an implant, a reinforcing of destructive mind states and leaving a mental residue. Let me expand on that. I spoke in the opening talk about one of the practice ways of optimizing a retreat is to follow the precepts, i.e. be ethical, and said that, you know, one of a contemplative understanding of ethics springs from or is founded on the recognition that unethical behavior stems from painful, destructive states of mind, again, greed, fear, anger, jealousy, etc., pride, and reinforces them. And on the other hand, that ethical behavior stems from positive, joyful, beneficent motives and emotions like joy, love, generosity, compassion, kindness, and strengthens those. Now that's rarely known in our, rarely seen in our culture. And unethical actions also leave their imprint. In classical terms, this is karma. In contemporary terms, unethical behavior conditions negative behavioral patterns, or what the neurologists called creates greased neural pathways. In simple language, it just makes us more likely to do that again. And that's one of the long-term costs, that the unethical actions become easily slip into habits and then into a way of life. And so this sets up a vicious cycle. And then we find ourselves being unethical to cover up our unethicality. You ever notice you tell one little lie and then you got to tell another to cover that, and then it gets very complex after a while. So, and one of the things that's very hard to recognize until you actually work at and explore ethics is that being unethical clouds the mind. Unethical actions, because they create, for example, fear and guilt and reinforce jealousy and so forth. All these, one of the reasons we try to reduce these destructive motives and emotions is because they cloud the mind, they create delusion. And as we talked about during Lama Surya's talk a couple of days ago, One of the things that unethical actions do, and this we all know, is they create guilt. And again, to draw that crucial distinction between regret and guilt, you know, regret is a simple can be a simple recognition that we made a mistake. Guilt is the recognition we made a mistake coupled with self-attack, often with self-hatred. And guilt is very destructive. Now, I used to believe that wise, mature people never made mistakes. I was very wrong. I've had the privilege of being around some wise, mature people, and they all turn out to be human. So now I've come to believe that everyone makes mistakes, and that the key thing is that everyone screws up, but wise people clean up. Neurotic people, that's us, or me, I shouldn't generalize. Most people make mistakes, become guilty, and cling to their guilt. Wise people make mistakes, correct the situation, and let any guilt go. In fact, let the situation go. They don't wallow in guilt or self-attack of any kind. They just do what needs to be done to clean up the situation as best they can and move on. They learn from it and they move on. And I want to suggest something pretty radical that I wouldn't talk about in public, but in a community like this, and say, for mature people, as far as I can see, guilt is an unnecessary emotion. Now, we have been trained to believe we need to feel guilty or we'll run amok. I want to suggest that guilt may be necessary and appropriate for kids and for a significant number of adults. But I want to suggest that as we mature, as we do this work, guilt becomes less and less helpful and more destructive. So I really want to get that across, because unless you let that in, you will keep believing you should feel guilty. Okay? What do we think about someone in this culture who screws up and doesn't feel guilty? We think they're bad. You're meant to feel guilty if you screw up. Okay. But at a certain level, as far as I can see, it just becomes destructive. Unless you let that in, that belief you should feel guilty if you make a mistake will play havoc with you. There are also psychosomatic costs of being unethical. It even gets into the body. Here's a beautiful story from Rachel Remen, a very wise woman, her book, Kitchen Table Wisdom. I highly recommend this book. If you haven't read it, it's just a collection of short stories by this physician, Rachel Remen, who works with people with life-threatening illness. And there are these wonderful stories. You'll laugh, you'll cry. It's the number one book I recommend to medical students to keep themselves sane while they're going through their training. Okay. And put it by you. Do yourself a favor. Put it by your bed and read a story before you go to sleep. You'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll be moved, and you'll get a transmission. Here's one of the stories. A woman with heart disease had suffered frequent chest pain. Over the years, she modified her diet, learned to meditate, and had been successful in controlling most of her pain. Yet some pain was resistant to all her efforts. Paying very close attention to this, she was shocked to notice that she experienced pain when she was about to do or say something that lacked integrity, that really wasn't true to her values. These were usually small things, like not telling her husband something he didn't seem to want to hear, or stretching her values a bit in order to go along with others. The times when she allowed who she really was to become invisible. But what was even more surprising was that sometimes she'd know what was happening, but sometimes the chest pain would come first. And only then, when she examined the circumstances which provoked it, would she realize for the first time that she had been betraying her integrity. Stress may be as much a question of compromise of values as it is a matter of external time pressure and fear of failure. Beautiful story. So, in summary, talking about the costs of unethical behavior, the karmic costs and consequences of being unethical are far greater than we usually recognize. And when we begin to recognize these costs, we're naturally moved, not out of sacrifice, but naturally for our own well-being, to be as ethical as we can. Now, the positive side of this is, of course, that there are a lot of benefits to being ethical. Being ethical creates benefits for both ourselves and others. Being ethical inhibits unskillful mind states and motives. It reduces the five poisons, inhibits them. In contemporary psychological language, it reciprocally inhibits these five poisons and unskillful mind states because they counteract one another. And it reduces guilt. If you haven't been unethical, you don't have to feel guilt, whether someone else wants you to or not. And this gives power. It gives both personal power and interpersonal power. Because a significant number of interactions and relationships are based on the game, I won't call you on your game if you won't call me on yours. Okay? And as long as you are harboring guilt over screwing up and doing things that you know aren't appropriate, you will feel guilty and you will be tempted to go along with the game. Which means you are reinforcing guilt and unethical behavior in yourself and others. Okay? In fact, it's even more interesting than that. Because as long as you're being unethical, you can't really afford other people to be ethical. Because that would show you up and they might call you a game. So you start to have a vested interest in other people not being any more ethical than you are. But when you are ethical, and as you do practice in this way, as you everyone here has been for a significant amount of time, you can stop these games. You have the personal and interpersonal power not to play these games, and you strengthen positive mental factors: love, joy, generosity, kindness. And this provides a foundation for spiritual growth. And being ethical makes you happy. Because here's a really crucial thing. What you intend for another, you tend to experience yourself. And if you're intending well-being and love and joy for other people, that's what you intend to experience yourself. Here are the words of the Buddha. Speak and act with a pure mind, and happiness will follow you. Just as your shadow, unshakably, set your heart on doing good, do it over and over again, and you will be filled with joy. The Buddha called this the bliss of blamelessness. And one beautiful consequence of this is that being ethical makes you a safe person to be around. I'd like to offer a little exercise. Close your eyes for a moment and take a few breaths. Notice how you feel. And now imagine that you are with someone who is really unethical, untrustworthy, aggressive, would do you in for their own benefit. What's it feel like? And now imagine that you're surrounded by a group of unethical, untrustworthy people. What's that feel like? And take a few breaths and let that go. And now imagine that you're with someone who's really ethical, a person who's kind and caring and benevolent. How do you feel? And now imagine that you're surrounded by a group of people who are really ethical, people who are kind, caring, well-wishing, warm-hearted. What's that feel like? And now realize that you are at this moment surrounded by a group of extremely ethical, benevolent, well-wishing people. What's that feel like? And when you're ready, open your eyes. Anyone not notice a difference? Pretty powerful, isn't it? So that's the gift that cultivating ethics allows us to give to people. It makes us safe. And it makes us beneficent. And it spreads. So that raises the obvious question, how do we develop our ethics? How do we cultivate ethicality? Well, there's a general answer and a specific answer. The general answer is the answer to questions about how you cultivate any virtue. You do your practice. You take up a spiritual discipline, which is what all of us here have done. And as we practice a spiritual discipline, in this case the Eightfold Path and the various practices of Buddhism, then those practices cultivate multiple positive qualities or virtues, and they all tend to foster and support one another, including ethics. But then, in addition, if you wish, you can also do focused practices which focus specifically on refining and cultivating ethics. And the way you do this is basically through specific practices and a series of experiments, which you can do if you want. And the general tenor or theme of a lot of these exercises is that you begin by doing experiments in which you aim to be as ethical as possible and to learn as much as possible from that. We can call it ethical ed. And these fall naturally into, we can divide them primarily into right speech and right action. which you'll recognize as two of the elements of the Eightfold Path. Now, speech is very potent, both in its effects on us and on those we speak to. And I would hazard a guess that almost everyone has had memories come up during these last few days of times when someone said something unkind or unethical to you, or you may have done the same to them, and of times when someone has been really kind and warm, and probably one of times when you've been so also. It's very interesting that the memories which come up and that require processing with most intensity are usually ones with an ethical flavor around them. And I'm sure you've noticed that. So here are some exercises that you could do, basically to cultivate right speech and to practice truth-telling, thereby giving the lie to Mark Twain saying that truth is so very precious, man is naturally economical in its use. So here's a very interesting exercise, I suggest. Make a commitment for one day to tell the truth, and only the truth. Now, usually when this is suggested, most people's minds go to the most difficult and horrendous situation they can think of. And unfortunately, people tend to get very uptight about this idea because most people have a very mistaken idea about what telling the truth means. Most people think that telling the truth means blurting out the worst possible, you know, thoughts, you know, and things you've ever done and ever thought and etc. ever intended. This may not be skillful. Here's a beautiful test. I have found no more exquisite summary of right speech than these seven words from the Buddha. Say only what is true and helpful. That is the best summary I have found anywhere. Say only what is true and helpful. So if you want to commit to doing an experiment of telling the truth for a day, that doesn't mean saying every stupid or destructive thought that comes to mind, because there are an awful lot of them. You'll have a very busy day. No, it means saying what is true and helpful. Okay. And as part of this exercise, do it as a meditative process. That is, if you're tempted to fudge at all, bring awareness to it, be as mindful as you can, notice the motives and emotions that arose that inclined you in that direction. Notice if there was fear or greed or embarrassment or jealousy or whatever. And learn. Okay? And over the years, I have come to feel that some of the most profound words that have been uttered are those of Jesus: the truth will set you free. This is a bottomless statement. Now, a couple of other interesting things about telling the truth. To tell the truth, first, there's only one thing you can actually ever tell the truth about: your experience. Okay? As soon as you start spinning out about the way things are, or the way that person should be, etc., you're off in mind space. Okay? You're often your beliefs and your interpretations and projections and defenses and so forth. All you can ever be sure to tell the truth about is your own experience. Okay? And it's very interesting if you only talk about your own experience, it's very interesting how that removes an awful lot of possible destructive statements. So a day of truth-telling means really telling the truth about your experience in a way that is both truthful and helpful. Here's the Buddha again. Wise people offend no one, yet they speak the truth. Their words are clear, but never harsh. They do not take offense, and they do not give it. Beautiful. Second exercise for right speech. Give up gossip. In general, as the general principle is, if you want to do this experiment, say only about someone what you've already said to them or would be willing to say to them. It's a good test. That is, if you're talking about someone who's not present, say only about them what you've already said to them directly or would be willing to. And in cross traditions, we find the recommendation to say what is true and helpful and not to gossip. The Jewish Torah warns us to be wary of the gossips and double-tongued, for they destroy the peace of many. Many have fallen by the edge of the sword, but not as many as have fallen because of the tongue. Well, here's the wonderful Taoist sage Lao Tzu. Curb your tongue and senses, and you are beyond trouble. Let them loose, and you're beyond help. Okay, so those are a couple of exercises to play. You can play with for right speech. Very powerful. Here are a couple for right act, or a few for right action. First, here's one you probably don't expect. Reflect on the good things you've done. Reflect on your good deeds. Okay, close your eyes. Take a couple of breaths. And bring to mind three things that you've done that you feel really good about. How do you feel? And what can you learn from this experience? Good. And when you're ready, open your eyes. Okay, so that's one thing. Reflect on your good deeds. You feel good and you feel inspired. Second exercise, a parallel to the truth-telling. For a period of time, maybe a day, practice harmlessness. Try not to harm any living creature. If a mosquito lands on you, do as the Dalai Lama does, gently brush it aside. Try to act in ways which don't bring any harm to anyone. Third, there's a general practice that I'm not going to go into here, but for those of you who have done the Nundro, the foundational practices of Vajrayana, then of course you know the Vajrasattva practice, which is a purification practice. Very powerful. That's a wonderful one. But now just fourth, back to exercises. Here's a simple, valuable exercise. Correct something, correct a wrong, or right a wrong, or make amends in some way. That is, correct or compensate for something unskillful you may have done. So, again, just for a minute, relax and close your eyes. And bring to mind some unethical act that you committed, maybe quite minor, which remains incomplete for you. That is, you haven't corrected it, or around which you still feel some discomfort or guilt. And what could you do to complete this? For example, could you correct it or compensate for it or apologize? Just see if there's anything you might be able to do to bring this to completion for yourself so it no longer causes you pain. And if it feels right, but only if it feels right, make a commitment to complete this. Okay, open your eyes. Here's a fifth exercise, which is very powerful. More demanding, but very powerful. Take an ethical inventory. That is, and this, those of you who are familiar with 12-step programs will recognize this as step four. We made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. That is, to take an ethical or moral inventory, you basically take some time and create a list of all the foolish things we've done. Okay? All the things which remain incomplete for you. That is, by incomplete meaning, still has some charge for you, still causes you some pain. Okay? All the unhealed relationships, all the things that haven't been communicated that should be. For example, who in your life do you love but you haven't told them that? It's a very simple one. Who haven't you thanked or acknowledged? And if you were to die tomorrow, what would you regret not having said or done? So creating an ethical inventory or a moral inventory is a very powerful exercise. And this is not a one-day thing. This is something, you know, take some time over and just reflect on and compile a list. And then if you want to take this to the next step, and I would certainly recommend it, you would move on to, again, something that the AA community does. The AA community is very good on these kind of things. They communicate your inventory to a trusted friend, a teacher, a wise counselor, a wise friend, someone you can communicate your ethical inventory to, who will be able to hear it without judgment or condemnation, will be able to take it in with love and acceptance and support. This is AA step 5. We admitted to God ourselves and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. And then exercise 7, as you can recognize, these are fairly advanced exercises. You know, these are not things I would be giving to the average group of people. But all of you have made this kind of commitment. All of you have been practicing ethics for, in some cases, for many years. And you've done the foundational work. So if you wish to take it to the next step, make a commitment to work through your inventory and to correct, clean up, and complete your life. That is, as much as you can, you go through your inventory and see what could be corrected and what could be completed, and you do it. Make a commitment to do it. And again, this is one of the AA steps. I forget which one, but it goes something along the lines of we made a commitment to make amends, except where doing so would create harm to others. Okay. And there's extraordinary power in this, because when you are cleaning up at this level, then you make some remarkable discoveries. For example, you make the discovery that as long as there are things you feel guilty about, then you have what we could call free-floating guilt. That is, there's guilt floating around there that's just waiting to jump onto something. And we've all had the experience of doing something very minor and inconsequential, you know, some little mistake, and then feeling so disproportionately guilty about it. Because we have this free-floating guilt residue from things we haven't cleaned up in our life and is just waiting to glom on to something. And one of the things that happens in interviews is a lot of people come in, you know, talking about the intense guilt they feel, usually about very minor things. I mean, people who come to retreat are usually living very clean lives, certainly by comparison with the conventional world. And then, as a final exercise, and this one's a lifetime one, we just increasingly make ethics an increasingly pervasive part of our practice, our path, and our lives. So, when we screw up, we clean up. Okay? And one of the beauties is we tend not to screw up as much, but when we do, we clean up. And one does one's ethical, one attempts to be as sensitive to ethical issues in one's life as one can and handle them as appropriately as one can. And we invariably fail. Remember, you know, everyone screws up. Ram Dass has a very nice saying. He used to say that spiritual life progresses one body length at a time. You take a step, you fall flat on your face. You pick yourself up. You take another step, you fall on your face. And you pick yourself up. So it goes. Now, as you can see, as I've been talking, I've been kind of starting off with fairly simple stuff and moving into what are really very advanced and effectively lifetime practices. These are, you know, this is a very high level of ethics, certainly by our cultural standards, that we're talking about here. And I guarantee you that, as you know for yourselves already, but I, you know, to, as you continue this, I guarantee it, it will transform and free you in multiple ways. Because as you work with these kind of higher reaches of ethics, then what you'll find is that as this increasingly becomes part of your life, then of course there's less anxiety, less guilt, less agitation. That in turn clears and clarifies and calms the mind. It makes it easier to cultivate other virtues. And gradually, what's the practice of ethics, which started as an effortful, sometimes quite difficult process, becomes increasingly spontaneous, natural, effortless, joyful expression of your being. And as this develops, this becomes what in Buddhism is called effortless effort. And if you know, those of you who know the ox herding pictures, I think the sixth ox herding picture is after struggling with the ox and taming the ox, is riding the ox home. You see this person sitting on the ox playing a flute and riding the ox home. That is, practice has become a spontaneous, effortless, joyful way of being. Okay? And as you practice in this way, and the mind clarifies and calms and becomes more able to see, you recognize that formerly living an unethical, unspiritual life was like living in a smoggy city. Just when you live in, say, Los Angeles or any smoggy city, you don't recognize what garbage you're living in. It's only when you climb up in the mountains outside the city and look back and you realize, oh my God, I was living in that. Okay, that's what it's like with ethics and spiritual practice in general. As you practice, you begin to get clearer and you remember what it was like. And you see what it's like when you slip back. And practice becomes, it's not an effort anymore, you want to live ethically. Again, one of the key recognitions of spiritual practice is that spiritual practice is not self-sacrifice. We recognize as we practice more that this is actually what we want to do. We want to do and be these qualities that we're cultivating. And furthermore, we recognize that we're not who we thought we were. And particularly that what we were busy defending and lying and cheating to protect was merely an illusion of ourselves. Merely a frightened fragment of our minds. And that who we are is in need of no defense. Doesn't need protection. Doesn't need to lie or cheat or anything. And you look out on the world and see yourself in all beings. There are no others to lie or cheat or mistreat. As the Buddha said, whatever you do to yourself. As Jack Kornfield put it, at first precepts, ethics, are a practice. Then they become a necessity and finally a joy. When our heart is awakened, they spontaneously illuminate our way in the world. This is called shining virtue. The light around someone who speaks truth, who consistently acts with compassion for all, is visible to all around them. You realize that ethical living is a natural, spontaneous, joyful expression of your true nature. We practice being a Buddha until we recognize we are a Buddha. Until we recognize that ethics and all these practices are actually exactly what we want. And they become a spontaneous, rather than falling in the illusion of that we're climbing up, as Lama Surya said, or only climbing up, we recognize that these qualities and these practices are actually an expression of who we are. I remember going in for an interview with my Zen teacher, and he said, the way we set it up here is, for those people who don't recognize their Buddha, we let them act in a way which lets them become Buddha. For those who know they are Buddha, we let them do the same thing as Buddha. Oh, that's the secret of ethics. Okay, so we did a long meditation and a rather long talk, so we don't have a lot of time here. Maybe if there are a couple of comments or questions. Oh, kitchen table wisdom. Oh, and there's a wonderful book on the integration of Buddhism and AA, which deals in wonderful depth with ethics, and that is One Breath at a Time by Kevin Griffin. Yeah, please.
I have a question about aggression and ethics and the interplay between those two. I have sort of a profession that's both aggressive and unethical at times. And so I'm wondering sort of what your views are. Somebody once told me that if you're aggressive from the get-go, that you have an advantage, that sort of the best defense is a good offense. And I have found in my profession that that's somewhat true. So I'm a litigator. And so if I depose somebody meanly, I end up with good answers and I can win the case. But unfortunately, it's not always easy for me to be mean. I tend to find...
What a problem.
Well, you would think, in life, it's very fortunate. But professionally, it's very challenging because, of course, my opposing counsel is 30 years older and 30 years with more experience and meaner and often unethical. And you would hope that a judge would see that, but they don't always, because they're human too, and they're taken by this other opposing counsel. So I'm wondering it's just something that I play with a lot about being aggressive or not aggressive or respectful or ethical.
I'll give you what comes up spontaneously in my mind. I think that's a fascinating call. I find it very intriguing, by a koan, I mean, a koan is something that is used in Zen. It's basically, I like to think of a koan as a question which each time you ask it, it takes you deeper into yourself and deeper into reality. And there are two kinds of questions in life, and it's very useful to know the distinction. There are knowledge questions. Is it raining outside? Nope. End of question. There are wisdom questions, which each time you ask them take you deeper into yourself and into life and invite you to look deeper and more effectively. I don't have an answer to your question because it's a wisdom question. It's a lifetime issue. And I would... First, I would congratulate you that you are in this very challenging and seductive environment and willing to look as deeply as you obviously are at the issues. And I would just encourage you to look as deeply, continue looking as deeply as you can, and to feel as deeply as you can into your own inner guidance and wisdom as to what is most skillful. Okay, again, what will be most beneficial to everyone in this situation? And since I don't have an answer, I'll tell you a story. And this is a story, the Ram Dass story. And Ram Dass Ram Dass was Richard Alpert of Harvard, who attained fame first by, along with Tim Leary, being one of the only two professors ever fired from Harvard, in his case for doing psychedelic experiments. And then he went off to India and took up spiritual practice and found a guru, Neem Karoli Baba, who a lot of people were influenced by, a very, very powerful, awake man. And Neem Karoli Baba was giving a talk on anger and saying, you know, give up anger, you know, let it go, it's destructive, etc. And Ram Dass said, well, Neem Karoli Baba, can't I even use anger as a teaching tool? And Neem Karoli Baba leaned up and put his face right in front of Ram Dass and said, no! So, no, you can't use it. Yeah. Thank you. I, you know, hopefully we'll meet again. I'd love to hear how this unfolds for you, because I think it's a very interesting issue. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, one more. Thanks.
I think I'm not alone in this room who struggles with the issue, the difference between remorse and guilt. I think young people probably, especially the newer, younger generations, have not been probably brought in an environment of cultivation of guilt. You mentioned Vajrasattva, purification practice. And in fact, even before you mentioned it, I just wanted to touch it. In the introductory prayer, and I quote at least the words I have been taught, with greatest remorse, regret, and revulsion. Remorse, regret, and revulsion. And in that moment, you bring to yourself the most evil acts you probably are ashamed of, and you regret, and you have remorse. But at the same time, it pierces like a knife again and again, because some of these, you talked about cleaning up and fixing up things. But some things cannot be cleaned up for various reasons. Individuals may be dead, things which happened are long gone. Essentially, this is my question. Where is the difference? How to really mop up this guilt?
First, not every action, the consequences of every action may not, let me try this again. It is not always possible to correct the external consequences of an action. It is usually possible to come to completion internally with an action through spiritual practice, through Vajrasattva, through psychotherapy, through communication, confession, whatever. One of the things you learn in doing interviews with people, and in my case as a psychotherapist, is a lot of people assume there is no way I could ever, you know, let go of that guilt or that, you know, etc. And people discover that often they can. So again, I think it's important to draw a distinction between external remediation and internal completion. Okay, where possible, we remediate any external damage, and even if that's not possible, we do our inner work to bring healing and release of guilt. As the Vajrasattva practice with the words, the practice I did not include revulsion. I'm happy to say I would have happily left that word out anyway if it had. I don't think that's skillful. The aim of the Vajrasattva practice is to raise regret and relinquish the karmic consequences, including guilt, of any unskillful actions in the past. Let me just close by telling another story, and that is that one of the most beneficial things I ever heard in a retreat was a simple throwaway line by a teacher. He said, you know, and all of us have done so many countless foolish things. I thought, oh, I'm not the only one. Oh, and that's part of being human. And we can see them as foolish rather than evil. Okay. And here's a question that is worth reflecting on, maybe for a lifetime. Do you want to see sins or do you want to see mistakes? It's our choice. If you look for sins and see, you'll find sins and you will suffer. If you look for mistakes, you'll find errors that can be corrected and learned from. One leads to suffering, one leads to happiness. I know what I want. Okay, so may our explorations of ethics lead us to be more and more kind and compassionate and caring. May it lead us to recognize that we can let go guilt and pain from the past. And may it enable us to be ever more effective instruments of help and healing and joy in the world.